Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, you'll hear from 98-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole. In 1942, Cole was one of 80 men who left on a top-secret mission to bomb Japan 4 months after they bombed Pearl Harbor. WISO's Conrad Balliet has seen poetry in a whole new way. He'll tell us about that. And later in the program, Bill Felker has Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, Governor Kasich's private job creation entity, Jobs Ohio, has been at the center of controversy since it began. It has also faced legal challenges. Because it's partially a private board, it's free from some of the regulations and public scrutiny that government organizations face. This week, WISO's Emily McCord spoke with Karen Kassler of Ohio Public Radio about all of this.
I'm hoping you can break this down for me. We're not talking this week about whether or not Jobs Ohio is constitutional.
Right. This is a pretty simple case, and this one has implications to other cases, I believe. This is basically who can, as an advocacy group, or whether an advocacy group, can challenge a law such as the law that created Jobs Ohio. So what you have is this advocacy group, this coalition of some very interesting folks, Progress Ohio, which is a progressive group, two Democratic state lawmakers, one current and one former, and the conservative Ohio Roundtable, which is an anti-gambling group mostly, and then the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law, which is a Tea Party-backed organization. So you have these very different groups that have come together all to oppose Jobs Ohio. They all think it's unconstitutional. But the question now is whether they, as a group, have a right to challenge the law in court.
The question is whether or not they have a right to do it. If it's not them, who would it be?
Well, and that's one of the key questions that was asked by Justice Maureen O'Connor in these arguments. If you don't have the right to do this, then who does? And so that's kind of gets to the question. There is no taxpayer standing, so to speak, in state law. In other words, as a taxpayer, you can't go to court and complain about how your money is being spent. But there's a question in terms of precedent about who actually can challenge certain laws. The Jobs Ohio side says that there are limits. You have to be injured by the law. You have to have a direct connection to the law. And so they say people like liquor permit holders and people who might not have gotten contracts with Jobs Ohio, they have an obligation and an opportunity to sue, rather. And the Progress Ohio says, no, we have an opportunity to sue because if we don't, no one will. We feel that we are the defenders of the Constitution as average Ohioans. And so we should have the chance to come here and ask if this law is constitutional or not.
Now, Jobs Ohio, as it has been challenged legally in the past.
Well, this is a case that's been a long way coming. And in fact, Progress Ohio's head, Brian Rothenberg, even quoted the Grateful Dead in the press conference afterwards, saying what a long, strange trip it's been. This has just been the first step, though, in the long case of going to the Ohio Supreme Court to finally get a ruling on whether Jobs Ohio is constitutional. We'll only get that ruling, though, if indeed it's determined that Progress Ohio has legal standing. The court, in my opinion, I'm not a lawyer, but the court seems to be able to go two ways here. They could rule that Progress Ohio has no standing and the case is over. But that also affects other cases, including a lawsuit filed by Progress Ohio and the Ohio Roundtable against video lottery terminals at horse racing tracks. Then there's the other possibility that Progress Ohio will be seen as having standing, and then the justices could potentially rule on whether Jobs Ohio is constitutional. And by the way, even if the case stops here, there were a couple of hints in the arguments about where other cases might go. Certainly there could be lawsuits over transparency and lawsuits over other things related to Jobs Ohio, but this is the main one about constitutionality, but we won't get that until we decide standing.
Now, if we're just at the first step at this point, looking at who can even bring up the case, how long is this going to take to get anywhere on this?
That's a really good question. It's going to be potentially a year or more. Maurice Thompson said that his case on Medicaid expansion, he feels that will be decided before the standing case, and this one will. And if indeed the court rules that Progress Ohio does have standing, then it goes back to the trial court, and the whole thing starts all over again. And so it could potentially be years before this could work its way back to the Ohio Supreme Court. And if it does, and if the court actually does decide that Jobs Ohio is unconstitutional, then you get into the whole issue of how do you unravel this and what do you do about it? And that would be a whole other question in and of itself. But the court has never been shy about telling the state that laws were unconstitutional. It ruled against school funding four times. And so I wouldn't begin to predict what this court is going to do with this case and with a possible constitutional case later.
I've been speaking with Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
It's been 5 years since the housing bubble burst. Lots of people in the Dayton area lost their homes to foreclosure, and many of those homes are still sitting vacant. Now, Lewis Wallace talks with Jim McCarthy about the Miami Valley Fair Housing Commission's case against big banks.
The Miami Valley Fair Housing Center is part of three national claims accusing banks of racial discrimination. They say the banks haven't taken care of properties in Black and Latino neighborhoods. I spoke to Jim McCarthy with the Fair Housing Center about the case.
We created a checklist of external curb appeal kind of things that you would look at. Is the grass cut? If trash has been dumped in the yard, is it picked up? Are invasive plants cleared away from the lot? If a window is broken, is it boarded and secured? If a door is broken open, is it boarded? What we found was that if a property was located in a suburban, primarily white community, it was being maintained at an appropriate level overall. If it was in an inner city minority community, it was not being maintained. And so we looked at properties that were owned by lenders, and we compared those properties, and we filed complaints against three national lenders, U.S. Bank, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo Bank. And we alleged that they were not meeting the responsibility, and by not meeting the responsibility, they were violating the Fair Housing Act and destabilizing neighborhoods.
What kinds of stories are you seeing from people who did have to foreclose on their homes?
They're sort of all over the place. So usually folks try and stay in the house as long as they possibly can. And then if that is not successful, they lose the home and they end up living with family or friends for a period of time. That typically lasts between 5 to 9 months. And then they either transition into a rental housing situation, usually substandard rental housing situation, because they can't afford very much, or they end up homeless.
We get these reports out every month now about the housing market, hearing that it's improving, that it's coming back, people are buying, prices are going back up. Do you see that reflected in the populations that you work with?
Well, I think that that is true, but the truth of the matter is in the Miami Valley area, though, we have never really seen double-digit property appreciation in the equity of properties. You know, on average, it runs between 2 and 4% in any given year. So it is not like the faster housing markets in Washington, D.C., San Francisco Bay Area, New York City.
Before or after the recession.
Exactly. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, if the world is going to end, I'm going to Cincinnati because it will happen there 10 years later. And, you know, we're all just a little ways up the road from Cincinnati. And so I think before we see the full effects of the recovery, it's going to be another 5 to 7 years.
When you look at what's happened since the recession, who are the biggest winners and who has really lost out in your view?
I think the big losers have been minority communities and moderate to low income communities. I'm hoping that through a variety of ways, some of them might be litigation, some of them might just be leadership on behalf of the banks. I'm hoping that some of the profit that they realized from the wild, wild west days of subprime and predatory lending will be returned to the community. If it isn't, then the American dream is going to be altered significantly for generations to come.
That's Jim McCarthy, who heads the Miami Valley Fair Housing Center. In June, Wells Fargo agreed to a $42 million settlement of the discrimination complaint, and that money is being distributed now to fair housing groups around the country. Complaints against Bank of America and U.S. Bank are still pending. Both banks have criticized the methodology of the discrimination study. This is Under Construction, WYSO's series on growth in the greater Dayton area. We dig underneath the physical and economic markers of growth to look at the human consequences. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Nearly 200 people turned out this week to hear five local university and college presidents discuss the landscape of higher education at a Meet the Presidents breakfast in Clark County that was sponsored by the Greater Springfield Chamber of Commerce. WYSO's Wayne Baker was there.
Clark State's Joalice Blondin was the only president of a two-year institution on the panel. She talked about the challenge and the recent spat with Sinclair University regarding the competition for students in Greene County.
As far as the higher education landscape tilting toward the two-year, I couldn't agree more. First of all, that's part of the value proposition I talked about at this breakfast meeting, which is that not only do we provide a very highly affordable education, but also a very high-quality education. And so I think that a lot of the four-year colleges, whereas before, in the past, and by the past I mean 20, 30 years ago, weren't as interested in partnering with the community colleges. Now they understand that that is a vital audience that they need to address in order to increase the educational attainment of this area. We've got a lot of great students. We have 5,000 students, and all those students get a two-year degree, and so many of them transfer to four-year institutions within the region, and those institutions were represented today. And so I know that the future of higher education, as I said, was, I quoted the statistic from the Center for Workforce and Education at Georgetown, 60% of the jobs that will be created by 2020 will require some post-secondary education, but not a four-year degree. And knowing that, and knowing the demographics of our region, we know that community colleges are more important than ever in workforce development.
Talk a little bit about an ongoing battle here with Sinclair to teach classes in the Dayton region.
Well, certainly we think of the possibility of collaboration and the opportunity to partner with Sinclair, certainly. And there is a lot of overlap with what we do in that region, and so we want to make sure that taxpayer dollars are conserved and that we're good stewards of those dollars and we're not duplicating services. But there are a number of areas, such as in the healthcare field, certainly in the unmanned aerial systems field, and in some other projects that we could really collaborate on and make a stronger workforce development program in Greene County, even stronger than it already is. We've served 1,365 students in the past year or so at our Greene Center in non-credit workforce training. We have 1,500 students, actually 1,498 students, at the Greene Center taking credit classes. So we want to make sure that we demonstrate our commitment to Greene County through not just our development of programs, but also through our investment in the region. And as I've said a few times, we have invested nearly $28 million in that facility, and we just want to make sure that any partnership that we enter into is not just mutually beneficial, but that it is also assisting the region in economic development, and that it's a true partnership and collaboration. So we look forward to working with Sinclair and strengthening that region.
Cedarville's Thomas White and Kirk Peterson of Urbana University were also panelists. White told the audience that Cedarville is embracing new technology but still delivering a classic faith-based education. Peterson, who has been hired as interim president at Urbana, stated that he was charged with hiring a new senior-level management team in order to change the university's business model to gain a more regional vision when it comes to academic partnerships and recruiting. Wittenberg President Lori Joyner felt the event was a valuable opportunity to discuss higher education and to talk about the university's decision to freeze tuition costs.
Well, I thought this was a wonderful opportunity for a number of presidents in the local area to have the opportunity to meet with the business community, talk a little bit about the mission of our institutions and what we're trying to accomplish, not just in terms of helping our students prepare for their future, but also helping to talk about our university's commitment to helping the local community through service hours and providing student interns and those sorts of things.
What's the biggest challenge facing Wittenberg now? And talk about the tuition freeze.
I think for most liberal arts institutions in this country, the greatest challenge has to do with creating a sustainable financial model. With the shrinking demographic, and what I mean by that is the smaller number of high school graduates that we're all competing for, really trying to figure out what our constellations of strength are and how we can best serve what I call best fit students. And so that's what we're working on at Wittenberg University, and at the same time, trying to make sure that we remain as accessible and affordable to students who want access to this first-rate liberal arts education. And so our Board of Trustees, for the second year in a row, has decided to freeze tuition and fees. And the other point that I made on the panel earlier is that with the commitment to financial aid of nearly $36 million at Wittenberg, the average price is actually very affordable and very competitive with some of our state flagship institutions.
Karen Schuster-Webb of Antioch University Midwest shared how the university is trying to continue its goal of serving adults seeking higher education while trying to overcome the mistake she feels universities and colleges have made of insulating themselves from businesses and the real world. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. 4 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, 80 men took off from an aircraft carrier on a top-secret mission to bomb Japan. They were led by Lieutenant Colonel James H. Jimmy Doolittle, and soon after they became known as the Doolittle Tokyo Raiders. This weekend marked the last time survivors of the raid would gather to honor their fallen comrades and offer up a toast. The remaining raiders are between the ages of 98 and 92 years old, and now, 71 years after their historic mission, three of the four made a final stop at the National Museum of the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Colonels Richard Cole and Edward Saylor, along with Staff Sergeant David Thatcher, were at the ceremony. Because of health problems, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hyde could not make the journey from his home in Tennessee. Before he made the trip, I spoke with 98-year-old Lieutenant Colonel Cole over the phone from his home in Texas. My first question was, of course, how was he doing? Here's what he said.
Well, as far as I know, I'm okay.
Thanks for speaking with me today. Can you just tell me a little bit about the mission in 1942? Tell me your experience.
Well, in 1942, I was a member of the 34th Squadron and the 17th Bomb Group, which had a B-25 airplane. We were originally in Pendleton, Oregon, and got transferred to Columbia, South Carolina. While at Columbia, the word was put out that they were looking for crews to go on a special mission. It just happened that the individual that upgraded me to a first pilot in a B-25 wanted to go, and we talked about it, and so we ended up crewing up together. We completed the training successfully, and a little while later, we were sent to Alameda, California, where we, along with our airplanes, were put aboard USS Hornet. We set sail on the 2nd of April in the Pacific area. We all knew we were going to take off from a carrier, and thought that in doing so, we were going to end up on an island someplace in the Pacific and fight the war. As it turned out, the mission people had other ideas, and we ended up with the task of bombing Tokyo. We were able to do that luckily, and do what the mission was designed for, and we ended up in China. After a while in China, some of us got to come home and some of us didn't. I was one of them that didn't, and ended up flying in a hump until June of 1943.
So you were in China over a year?
Yeah, China and India.
What were conditions like there?
Oh, they were like any campsite that the military sets up as they move along on working toward their objective.
What was it like to fly a B-25?
Well, as a young pilot, it was, I guess you'd call it the hot rod of the day.
Tell me what happened just after the mission. You ran out of gas, and so many of the other planes experienced that as well.
That's right, because number one, the weather was very bad, and we had no way of finding and it was at night, and we had no way of finding a place to land because the fog, rain, and everything was right down to the ground. But the fact that it was there wasn't all bad. It created a tailwind for us that causes wind to blow from east to west, and this is what helped us with a big boost to make it to China. Otherwise, we would have probably ended up in the water.
And some of your fellow soldiers did.
Yes.
What was it like bailing from the plane at night, not knowing where you were going to land?
For me, that was the scariest time of the whole mission. It was standing at 9,000 feet in an airplane, and you knew we were going to run out of gas, and you were going to have to bail out through that little black hole into some place that you'd never been and had never planned on being.
But you landed safely. Tell me about that.
Well, our whole crew landed safely. We lucked out and had no injuries.
How did this experience change you from the young pilot that you were and after the mission?
Well, I don't know that it changed me. Brought to surface a lot of things I'd never thought about. But any war mission does that depend upon what the mission is.
Was there anything specific that you thought about this mission? What kind of questions did it raise for you?
The biggest question is World War II, or one, in 1918, was supposed to be the mission that after which there would be no wars. And it caused me to think since that time, we haven't learned anything.
Let me ask you about the reunions. How has that been for you to attend these reunions over the last 70 years?
The reunion has been very interesting and enjoyable and a big morale booster to the ones that could attend. And I'm all for it.
What do you want people to remember about what happened in 1942 and the Doolittle Raider mission?
Well, I'd like for people to remember that that time the United States and its allies were in grave danger because the Japanese and their active things that they took, like the Philippines and the other islands in the South Pacific, that they had visions of going into Hawaii and India and Australia. And whatever the progress they could make, the big objective was to make sure that we would have to fight any kind of a war with them from the West Coast, which would have been extremely difficult.
Any final comments about the reunion coming up or looking back on the mission this many years later?
Well, I think it's an appropriate time to close the book.
Lieutenant Colonel Richard Cole, I want to thank you for your time and for your service to the country.
Well, thank you, and thank you for yours if you served.
I didn't, but my brother and my father did.
Thank you.
Hear more about the Doolittle Raiders' final toast at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. Recently, Conrad's Corner host, Conrad Balliott, visited a speech therapist and got to see his voice box on video as he recited a poem by W.B. Yeats. We've got that video on our website, WISO.org, and Conrad sat down with WISO's Juliet Fromholt to talk about his experience working with the speech therapist.
And she just had me say, whoosh, and whee, and had me speak things. And at one point she said, well, say something longer. And since, as you know, I do poetry on WISO and have a lot of poems in my head, and one of my favorite poems is W.B. Yeats, I have heard him read his own poetry, not in person, but he did a program for the BBC. And so I know how he read. In fact, one of the things he said was that, it took me a devil of a lot of trouble to get this into verse, and I will not read it as if it were prose. And he really reads in a peculiar way. It's almost like a chant. So I recited, I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, and a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And the whole thing is not that much again, but she thought that was fascinating. You know, I'm in my 80s, and I had no idea how the human voice box works. So I started talking about it and talking to my friends. A couple of them, I showed the video clips. And then it dawned on me, hey, this might be of interest in YouTube. So that's the background.
What was it like for you getting to see your voice sort of as it manifests?
It was just amazing. I had no idea how it looked. And it looked, I mean, it's a whole bunch of red tissue down there, muscles and things. But the little voice box itself, it works something like a reed, I think, in an oboe or a clarinet. And it opens and closes. It's white. All the rest of the stuff is red. And on some things, some pronunciations, you can see that those little white slots going back and forth in there. It was fun.
When you started recording poetry here, did you ever think that beyond just seeing your voice as waves on our recording equipment, that you would get to see the very physical part of your voice?
I never thought of it. And it is fascinating, incidentally, to see them when we record them here. I've been working with that process. But there's so many ways of doing this. I mean, you can see that wave that's going of what I'm saying now, and now I can see it as it's making the sound. And I've heard the recordings of Yeats read it. It's just a technical world that was not possible in the past.
Thank you so much, Conrad.
Well, thank you, Juliet.
Conrad Balliott, host of Conrad's Corner on WYSO, talking with Juliet Fromholt about his experience seeing his voice box on video as he recited poetry. You can watch that same video on our website, WYSO.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the first week of late fall. In warm late autumns, garlic mustard has grown 4 or 5 inches tall, its leaves wide and bright. Chickweed has come back all along the paths, and cress has revived in the pools and streams. Skunk cabbage has pushed up all over the swamp, and some plants are even opening a little. The low sun sets the new plants glowing like they glow in April. At the river's edge, the water is rippled blue, black, green, and brown, bare tree branches tangled in reflections. Warmed by the benign autumn and fed by the great bands of honeysuckle throughout the area, robins linger in town and in the woods. Juncos have arrived, and bluebirds make their last passage south along the rivers. Starlings cluck and whistle at sunrise. Cardinals and pileated woodpeckers and bobwhites sing off and on throughout the day. Finches and chickadees work the sweet gum fruits, digging out the seeds from their hollows. Sparrowhawks appear on the fences and watching for mice in the bare fields. Mosquitoes still wait for their prey near backwaters and puddles. Asian lady beetles, sometimes great hordes of them, look for crevices in which to spend the winter. Late woolly bear caterpillars, most of them dark orange and black, still emerge in the sun. Cabbage moths still look for cabbage. The last daddy longlegs linger in the woodpiles, and crickets still sing in the more gentle evenings. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of late fall. In the meantime, listen for the crickets on the milder evenings. They won't be singing for long.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney, coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.